Hi everyone, welcome to the Beverage Report podcast. I'm Sarah, I'm a third year economics student at LSE. In this episode, we talk to Professor Bemo from our very own Department of Economics here at the LSE on the topic of inequality. Special thanks to Annie, Sanjana, and Raza from the podcast team, Dr. Petropoulou, Dr. Shapiro, and Alice Odonko from the Department of Economics for their support in the making of this episode. We hope you enjoy it. Hi, Professor Mo. Thank you so much for joining us today. My first question is about inequality. We understand that the root cause of inequality within and across countries is such a long-standing economic question, which is also one of your research focuses. What do you find fascinating about studying inequality?
First of all, thanks very much for having me on the show. It's really great to be here. So I think mostly what I find fascinating about it is that as anyone who's ever looked at data, I guess in particular microdata on things like income and wealth and consumption, will tell you that there's a huge heterogeneity, so inequality in lots of these kind of economic outcomes. So first of all, it's just interesting because it's large. And I guess as a good economist, whenever you see something large or striking, you kind of wonder, why is that? What explains that? And then the second thing, I guess, is if you want to think about sort of human welfare and well-being, I think there's just sort of no way of getting around thinking about distribution. So, if you think about a country with a given level of GDP, it's just very different whether this same pie is distributed very equally or very unequally. So I guess and then finally, I would say, I think pretty much any policy question I can think of any policy you think about implementing will typically, if you think about it a little bit, generate both winners and losers. And you're going to want to have some way of thinking about it. And you're going to want to have the data for thinking about it. And you're going to want to have the sort of theories for thinking about it. So I guess my work is exactly sort of trying to provide those kind of theories and empirical work.
Great. The Gini coefficients is the most common measure of inequality. Do you agree with Thomas Piketty's critique that Gini lumps together income and wealth and misses much of the action at the top of the income distribution because perhaps the very rich tend not to report all their income or other reasons? What's your opinion on the Gini coefficient?
Right. Yeah, no, first of all, I 100% agree that just looking at Gini coefficients is a bit limiting. I would disagree a bit that a problem of the Gini is that it lumps together income and wealth. I mean, that's not really the case. I mean, you can just compute separate Gini coefficients for income and wealth. I guess in practice, for whatever reason, people tend to look at income Ginis and sort of not wealth. So that's obviously sort of a mistake. But I think there's a sort of a much more conceptual problem with Gini coefficients, which is not only true for Gini coefficients, but also most sort of summary statistics for inequality that people sometimes compute, things like a 90-10 percentile ratio or a 90-50 percentile ratio, or just the variance of the logs of income or something like this, or tile index, all the inequality indices, which is that basically you cannot summarize a distribution with one number. Whenever you try to summarize a distribution with one number, you're going to lose information. And so, for example, Gini coefficient will only tell you sort of to a very limited extent what's going on in a particular part of the distribution, say the top of the distribution. And what we've seen in the data is that, there's lots of increase in inequality, say, at the very top of the distribution, and then you're not going to necessarily pick that up, or not very clearly, at least, in the Gini coefficient. Then there's finally the sort of separate measurement issues, which is, can you actually even measure the incomes of the very rich people? But that's sort of a separate question, I guess. And it's just a matter of getting better data. And in particular, over time, I think what we've seen is that there's more and more better data, in particular, sort of administrative data that sort of governments collect, for example, so tax data, and that will help you get a better picture of the income distribution.
In your paper, Automation's Impact on Income and Wealth Inequality, you emphasize that technology leads to higher inequality, not only through income differences, but more importantly through wealth differences. What's the reason behind this?
Right. So just to clarify, so the argument is that it's not just about labor income, but also about both labor and capital income and wealth. So basically, just as a background, there's a sort of a big literature that thinks about the effect of technology on income distribution, and the typical mechanism that people think about is the effect of technology on labor incomes. So for example, higher educated people will benefit more from new technologies than less educated people. So the most common of these theories is called skill bias technical change. Basically, the only thing we're saying is, hey, not all income is labor income. There's also capital income, and capital income is particularly important at the very top of the distribution. And then we're just saying, some of the benefits of particular forms of technology, so in particular automation, which is sort of technology that substitutes capital for labor in production, will accrue to owners of capital income. And so basically, just the way it works is, if you own, say, a factory, like think about sort of Zara, say, right, the clothes manufacturer. If now the owner of Zara goes and automates a lot of the production process, that will shift some of the income away from the workers and towards, capital. And I guess the owner of Zara is ultimately the owner of this capital, and he will therefore reap the rewards. And as a result, will get very rich in the process potentially. So that's kind of the basic story. So the automation increases capital income, and then people accumulate out of that.
Thank you. And the paper also highlights the impact of financial asset ownership on wealth inequality, with evidence drawing from the U.S. economy, which is highly developed and has a well-functioning financial market. How applicable is this lesson for developing economies or poorer regions?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say it's definitely different in a developing country, but some of the story would still be applicable. So, there's sort of two ways in which this is different. The first way in which developing countries are different, you've already said, which is that the financial markets are less developed. So, there may not be a well-developed stock market where, you can hold stocks in these companies that automate their production, say. The second one that's, I think, arguably even more important is that wages will typically be cheaper in developing countries. So labor is cheaper. So as a result, there may not be as much automation to begin with. Because basically what these theories predict is that, you're only going to automate, whether you're going to automate your production process is going to depend on the prices of your factors of production. So in particular, wages. So if wages are really low, you may not bother automating. So basically, I think these two things are what makes it different. That being said, I would say, to the extent there is automation in the developing countries, the fact that the capital isn't traded, so that aren't well-developed financial markets, may actually make the matter worse in a sense, because basically what will happen is that in developing countries, the ownership of capital will be very concentrated, and the people who own this capital, will just only benefit from these automation technologies themselves, rather than, say, selling off some of their stocks and these, productivity gains being more broadly shared. And you do see this a lot in developing countries, right, that you have these huge conglomerates and so on that are kind of owned by a particular family, say, rather than being traded on a stock market. And so I think, I haven't, worked this out fully, but I think what would happen if you put that kind of financial market structure in our model, you would get an even larger increase in wealth inequality.
In your paper, The Great Lockdown and the Big Stimulus argues that short lockdowns induce relatively small economic costs but drastically reduce deaths. That just got me thinking, what are the challenges economists face when weighing the benefits of lockdowns against its costs?
Right. No, also really interesting question. Let me actually answer this question by first saying what I think is actually easy about weighing the benefits and costs of lockdowns, and then tell you what I think is hard about it. So the first thing that's easy, I think, is that if you think about this for not very long, there's sort of two simplistic views you can sort of dismiss pretty quickly. The first one is, which you hear sometimes in the public debate, you know, if there hadn't been a lockdown, the economy would have just been fine, right? That it's sort of all the economic cost is due to the lockdown. So there's a huge trade-off, would basically be the view. And I think that's sort of obviously wrong, because the fact that because there's a pandemic, people will respond to this pandemic even if there's no lockdown. So what economists call sometimes voluntary social distancing, or I guess another word for it would be sort of a fear factor, which is that, you know, if there's a pandemic raging, people are just gonna stay home, not go to restaurants anymore or less, I guess, and travel less, even if there's no lockdown, and you would have had a huge or arguably big recession, even in the absence of a lockdown. And the second thing is the second simplistic view that one can dismiss, I think, is sort of the opposite view, which is that for the type of lockdowns we've seen in the UK, so relatively blunt lockdowns, some people say there is no trade-off at all between sort of lives and livelihoods. And I think that's also kind of wrong. That may be the case with other policies, but with sort of blunt lockdowns where you just shut down everything, I think there definitely is a lockdown. And then there's a question sort of how you quantify that lockdown. And that's exactly what, you know, we've been working on. And then sort of to answer your question, basically, the thing that makes it really hard is that you need to know sort of what would have happened if there hadn't been a lockdown. So what some people sometimes call sort of the missing counterfactual of lockdown. So, you know, what would have happened with the UK economy if there hadn't been a lockdown? It's pretty clear, as I said earlier, that there would have been a recession of some sort because of this voluntary social distancing. But the question is sort of how large would that recession have been? And that then determines how large the trade-off is between saving lives and livelihoods if you do a lockdown. And so I guess, for example, in our work, the way we approach this is we look at, we build a model of the, in this case, United States economy, and then we can use that model to we discipline that model using some data, and then we use that model to run these kind of counterfactual scenarios. And there we get that relatively short lockdowns, at least, save a large number of lives at relatively low economic costs. But then as you increase the length of the lockdowns, you get, you at some point, the economic costs start to really explode on you, basically.
Okay. Now let's talk about books. What are your favorite books in economics or in general? And what books would you recommend to the undergraduate community at the LSE?
Right, I had to think about it a bit. So I would say I have five books on my list here. Okay, so the first thing is I generally really like reading sort of these older books, just to see what people were thinking sort of, 50 or 100 years ago. And actually one class of books that's often really interesting is just old undergraduate economics textbooks. So one that I would encourage undergrads to look at, just because I think it's really interesting, is there's a very classic undergraduate textbook simply called Economics, written by Paul Samuelson, who was obviously, one of the big economists of the 20th century and won a Nobel Prize. And this is like an edition from 1948. And I looked at this, at some point earlier this year, and I thought it was like super interesting to see how some things were very similar, how we think about them today, but some things were very different. And it's sort of just an interesting book to look at. And then second on my list is more recent book, simply called Inequality, by Tony Atkinson, who was one of the pioneers of the sort of inequality literature, and recently passed away. So that's sort of a description of a lot of his life's work, and it's very good. And then I have three more. The third one is a development economics book, actually, which is Poor Economics, that you may have seen at some point, by Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo, which I think is a very interesting and also exciting description of some cutting edge research, but sort of in a very accessible way. Fourth book is something about sort of growth across countries. So in particular, I have a book here, it's called The Miracle, The Epic Story of Asia's Quest for Wealth, by Michael Schumann. And it's sort of it's written by a journalist, but as a journalist who knows a lot of economic history, and it's sort of a very interesting account of some of the growth experiences of some of the Asian economies. So say Singapore or Japan and South Korea and Taiwan and so on. And there's sort of a separate chapter for each country, and it's sort of written in a very interesting way. And then the final one I have on my list is kind of a very nerdy book, but one I like a lot. Which is not really about economics, it's about sort of statistics, I guess, in a sense. It's called The Visual Display of Quantitative Information by Edward Tufte. And it sort of has both a history of basically information graphics, sort of how to present data, and then also it's sort of a style guide, sort of a trunk and white for how to display, how to make pretty graphs, basically. And I've always thought that was kind of a really neat book to look at.
Thank you very much. I'm sure our students, our listeners, are busy adding items on their list. Now, finally, something we ask every economist we have on the podcast: what gives you hope?
So one thing I should say, I think, is sort of I'm generally a pretty optimistic person. I'm sort of a glass half full kind of a guy. So, you know, if I look around me, I think there's lots of things that make me optimistic about the future, so that give me happiness. I mean, very basic things like my family, obviously, for example. But I mean, just also if I look around myself here at the LSE, I do think one thing that makes me optimistic is all the great students we have here, and how, in particular, passionate and engaged some of them are, not just about sort of economics, but also about sort of, you know, the world more generally. And I guess one thing that I found quite encouraging, actually, is that so during the whole last year and a half, when we had this pandemic and we had to do everything online, which was obviously kind of a tough time, I guess, particularly for you guys, for the students. I you know, whenever even though it was on a Zoom screen, there was still a lot of engagement and lots of passion for economics and sort of for understanding the world and for answering these policy questions, which I thought was kind of a very good sign that there's so much sort of resilience in the student population. And so that makes me definitely optimistic about the future. Now that we're back in person, hopefully fully soon, I think then I'll be really optimistic.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time. I'm really glad all the students and the faculty, we all muddled through the difficult time. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.